Welcome to the 115th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
It's 12 years to the day since Yuvraj Singh hit six straight sixes off a Stuart Broad over. Welcome to the podcast that has been hit into some front gardens, but never for six sixes.
Speak for yourself, have you ever been hidden into a front garden?
I have, yeah. Grey's Green Cricket Club near Henley. I came on to unleash a bit of my military medium pace. And was deposited second ball into someone's front garden. And I think it's the real embarrassment is the amount of time it takes to then retrieve the ball. So your humiliation is kind of extended for the entire duration of that process.
It's always puzzled me, people who buy houses next to cricket pitches knowingly. I remember a club I used to play with in Cambridge, and there was a beautiful row of houses next to this stunning ground in the middle of the countryside, and someone moved into one of them and used to get absolutely irate whenever a cricket ball was hit into their front garden, which was literally, you know, on the boundary. And you think, if you're going to move into a house with a cricket pitch next to it, you either have to love cricket or be pretty foolish if you don't think you're going to get a cricket ball. But anyway, in this podcast, we're going to be talking about Andy's recent visit to Lord's. We are going to be talking about a great Jack Leach moment, and no, not from the recent Ashes. And we're going to be reviewing A Clear Blue Sky, which is a book by Johnny Bairstow with Duncan Hamilton. As ever, if you enjoy the podcast, please do hop over onto iTunes and leave us a review there, and click on the five-star rating button. Apparently it's the only one that works for us, and it's a great way of getting other people to find us. Now, Andy, you spent a bit of time at Lord's recently.
We're coming to the end of the cricket season here, and there's always plenty of sadness to that. You kind of look at the fixture list, you think, oh God, I didn't get to quite as many games as I want to, and you make good intentions for next year. But my dad, brother and I went to the first day of Middlesex's championship game against Durham last week, and it was a treat. There were English, Aussie, West Indian and Irish internationals on show, and we were treated to 17 wickets in a day. Now, at lunch, as is traditional at Lord's, we were allowed to wander onto the field, and I still retain an utterly childish excitement at taking part in this tradition. Now, as soon as we walked on, we all instinctively reached down to touch the grass, and looking around, I saw many other fans at it as well. Proof that, mad as it may be, we all know that it's hallowed turf. It's a pleasure to wander around, soak up the beautiful ground, you know, enjoy the pavilion, sight of the pavilion, Father Time, the media stand. But I think this tradition's also important for what it represents, because we regularly worry about this issue of, do those who run cricket care about the fans? And this small lunchtime gesture, I think, is a really nice way of saying that the home of cricket ultimately does belong to those who turn up, watch and care.
Did you take any of the grass home? I've got a few little pots of grass from various grounds around the country. I never labelled them, so I'm not quite sure which one's which.
I didn't, you know, because it's a very, as I said, it's very generous. You're allowed to wander pretty freely, but there's also plenty of sort of security near the wickets. And I wonder
Tugging up great tufts is not quite the thing.
Well, you know, the other thing is they're not great tufts. You know, it is, I know it's a bit of a cliche, but it's almost kind of billiard top
it is.
Smooth.
It's always what amazes me is how good the outfields are. And you actually, I sometimes go onto those kinds of outfields and I think, no wonder they make it look easy when they field on outfields like these. You know, you don't go down for a long barrier and suddenly see the ball disappearing over your left shoulder because it's hit a divot. It's actually quite amazing sometimes seeing the quality of the, you know, the kind of golf green quality of some of those outfields.
Absolutely. I read an interview with a groundsman who said effectively Lord's is the biggest golf green in the world. You know, it is that sort of quality, it's that sort of surface. And I think that there's a very fascinating list to be made of the things that village cricketers have tougher than their professional peers, of which you're absolutely right. Fielding on divots is one of them. Now, you've been rather taken by the fact that it has been quite a dramatic week news-wise for several sporting stars.
Yeah, so there are a couple of stories that sort of seem to fall at around the same period. One of which was the Welsh Rugby Union legend Gareth Thomas revealing that he's been living with HIV. And then a couple of days after it, the story that The Sun ran, which was about the tragic past of Ben Stokes's family back in New Zealand, his mother's previous husband, and the story of his half brother and half sister, which isn't actually something that I kind of particularly want to tell the story of now, because that feels like kind of dignifying the story by retelling it. And actually, in both instances, it's quite kind of difficult to regard the stories without a feeling of quite sort of strong bad taste. Gareth Thomas was blackmailed effectively into telling his parents that he had HIV by the press, and ditto The Sun, you know, did a lot of digging in order to break the story about Ben Stokes's family. And Ben Stokes's family passed from about 30 years ago, and to do that the day after the Ashes as well, so to really capitalize on the moment when Ben Stokes was big in the public imagination and use it as a moment to have a front page that talked about some pretty awful news in his past. Quite apart from the sort of bad taste element, one thing that's quite interesting is some of the legal aspects of this. There have been quite a few interesting articles that talk about the legality of this kind of media coverage when it relates to sports people who are out in the sort of in the public domain. Then news about their families can be seen as being news of them can be seen as being in the public interest and therefore warranted. You know, if you agree to be an international sports superstar, then you agree to an element of press coverage of you. What's interesting here, particularly in the Ben Stokes story, is apparently it's going to raise a lot of questions about, well, how far does that actually extend to your family? How far does it extend to your mother's first marriage? Should they be in the limelight because of what Ben Stokes, a generation and a marriage apart, as it were, has achieved in terms of fame and notoriety? It's been also interesting reading these in the context of the book that we'll talk about later, the Johnny Bairstow autobiography, where he talks about his family tragedy, his father's suicide, and the kind of effect that had on him. And it's just been a really interesting week to reflect on what, you know, sports stars sometimes go through, and the way that the press can interact with them as well.
It seems to show a massive misreading of the public mood on behalf of The Sun. And I think one way The Sun has often been, I guess, praised or almost admired is its ability often to read the public mood very effectively and respond to it. And I think if you've seen all the stuff on social media, I guess I've maybe seen more of it in relation to Stokes than in relation to Gareth Thomas. There's been huge, huge criticism. And it really reminded me of, you know, it's quite an old story now, but when The Sun got things hugely wrong over the boxer Frank Bruno, and when he was suffering mental health problems and was admitted to an asylum, and The Sun ran with the headline, "Bonkers Bruno Locked Up." And they completely misread the public mood and were so heavily criticised that by later in the day they were having to change the... And I think it's another interesting example of that, where sometimes this willingness to sort of have a go at, or as you say, kind of dig into stuff that is really unclear whether it's in the public interest, I think can backfire. And it, curious, obviously, to see whether it has any more substantial long-term ramifications for The Sun. From the archives, and in this episode, Toby is delving into the history of England's newfound bespectacled spinning talisman.
There's something about spinners and spectacles, isn't there? I mean, you think back to good old Daniel Vittori. Wasn't there a Sri Lankan spinner a little while ago? I was trying to remember who it was who wore glasses on the pitch. Anyway, Jack Leach really, you know, in many ways sort of stole the summer. He was the unlikely hero. He gave hope to all of us that have gone through our lives half blind. And I was thinking about this and actually remembering back to last year, to 2018, which was really the first time that Jack Leach came in a substantial way onto my radar. He had a huge county season in 2016. But it was his starring part in a very, very curious game last year that I think was quite significant for him. So let's go back first to the beginning of the 2018 season, and in May, very beginning of the season, Lancashire entertain Somerset in a game, Lancashire at home, that turns into an absolute feast of runs. So there's there are centuries for Marcus Trescothick, for George Bartlett, for Keaton Jennings, and a double for Dane Villas, and the game ends in a predictable draw. Good old Jack Leach in the one innings that he bowls in, so Lancashire actually only end up batting once. He bowls for 46 overs in an innings. I mean, that's the state the obvious. It's basically an entire one day international innings that he bowls himself. He takes 3 wickets, which is actually not bad going on a pitch that massively favours the batsman. So that's early season. Flip to the end of the season, and obviously the county championship is well progressed. Somerset are really the only likely contenders for the top spot against Surrey. Surrey are sitting at the top of the table. Somerset hoping to take the championship after having narrowly missed out for a few seasons. Lancashire at the other end of the table, looking to avoid relegation, and it's a game in early September, which is actually going to be quite vital for both of them, Somerset in achieving the championship and Lancashire avoiding relegation. Now, the game is really well set up because the Somerset pitch at Taunton, that beautiful, beautiful pitch under there with the church on there, the cathedral on the boundary, has been notorious for a little while. The previous year, Angus Fraser, the old England pace bowler, has lambasted it as awful. So we think we're set up for something quite interesting. Lancashire win the toss. They know all about the pitch, and they decided they're gonna bat first. There's absolutely no way that they wanted to end up batting last. Now, I would urge anyone to go and watch the highlights of this game. There are highlights packages that exist on YouTube, but I'm not going to go through a blow-by-blow account of how the game ran, other than to sort of give some of the milestones. So Lancashire should bat first, and Craig Overton and Jack Leach reduced them to 68 for 4, which actually on this pitch doesn't feel too bad. You think that you could make a sort of battling 150 at this stage, but actually the last 6 wickets fall for just 31 runs, and Lancashire in their first innings are all out for 99 in 39 overs, with Leach on a spinner's wicket taking 5 for 28. Now, clearly Somerset sniff a chance here of getting a first innings lead, but they're pegged back by consistent wickets throughout their innings until their final 3 batsmen add 88 runs, which really boosts their score so they have a lead of 100. Now, Craig Overton and Jack Leach actually batting at 10 and 11 are the people who managed to come in and secure those 2 final partnerships that actually take Somerset to their lead on the first innings.
It's quite an odd feature, often on difficult batting pitches, how often the tail seem to contribute runs, because there always seems to be this, you've seen the people who are supposed to score runs fail. You come out, the pressure almost sort of gone, and you kind of play with a bit more freedom. And it's odd how often this seems to happen, that you'll see a senior batsman playing so nervily and so cautiously, and a tail ender come in and sort of throw the bat at it. I guess it's one of the situations where actually there's a kind of fun in lower order batting.
I think it's definitely a great leveler when you have a pitch like this. It is something that sometimes you can get really quality batsmen who can graft and can make something of it, but often it is the case where someone hitting and hoping for a few overs and scoring, 20 through a few streaky boundaries and a couple that come off the middle can score more runs than someone, really grafting and then ending up getting out to a good ball. As illustration of that, there were 20 wickets that fell. So the first 2 innings happened on the first day. So 20 wickets fell on the first day of a 4-day game. And Lancashire actually end up coming in for their second innings at the end of the first day and lose 2 quick wickets, so both one of their openers and then the night watchman. So 22 wickets fall on the first day, and it's pretty clear which way this game is going, because Somerset have that first innings lead. Lancashire are already two wickets down, and when they return for the next day, remarkably, Lancashire actually managed to scrape together an innings of 170. And what is interesting about a game like this is suddenly you think an innings of 170, that's not much in a four-day championship game. But in this context, an innings of 170 is like an innings of 500 on a flat pitch. And this is thanks to Stephen Croft and the Lancashire captain, Liam Livingston. Jack Leach, again, having an absolute field day. He takes 7 for 74. He actually, again, to your point, he ends up conceding quite a lot of runs to the lower order, who end up just, you know, kind of opening their legs and just heaving him over mid-wicket quite a lot and getting lucky. So there are a couple of overs where he goes for 20 runs apiece. But ultimately, figures of 7 for 74 are not to be sniffed at. And Somerset are set 78 to win. By this point in the game, it could go anyway. You think 78 to win, surely they should be able to knock us over. This is a Somerset lineup with James Hildreth, with Mark Strathcothic opening the batting. Mark Strathcothic, by the way, he really living up to his nickname of bangers by this point in his career. He looks slightly as if he's got a pillow shoved up his shirt. Fielding at slip in a sort of slightly immobile kind of way.
You've kind of earned it at that point in your career, though, haven't you?
You really have. It is
you're at
that
age,
point where
you've been there, done that. You're going to sit in slips and you're going to let everyone else do the work.
Exactly. You can say to the captain, I'll open the batting and I'll stand at slip, and that's what I'm doing. And frankly, with Truscothic, you take that. So to cut a long story short, Somerset requiring 78 to win. They lose wickets rapidly, and they're 77 for 9. Jack Leach comes in at number 11. The scores are tied, and they require one run to win. Now, it's an interesting question as to how you play in this circumstance. And what is particularly puzzling, and even more so for the fact that this is a man who we saw bat so patiently in the Ashes, that Jack Leach decides that the only way to win this is not to prod a single. Obviously, a lot of the field is in for one. Not to prod a single, but to try and go for glory and hit it through, hit a spinner through mid-wicket for six. He faces three balls that beat the bat, and he defends. And then on the fourth one, he decides, right, this is my moment, and he picks a ball up. A well-pitched ball, and tries to hit it over mid-wicket, and gets caught on the boundary. And so the game is tied. It's the first county championship game to be tied since 2003, I think, so obviously a pretty rare occurrence.
You do wonder how much of this is kind of just pure adrenaline. That, as you say, I think it's hugely important context, not just the situation of the game and the championship, but your point that it'd just been beaten three times. By that point, you know, heart is thumping, adrenaline pumping, you know, is that the point where actually almost another part of your brain takes over and you just want it done, and you feel, you see the bowler coming, and you probably know at some level that what you should be doing is looking to kind of tip and run, but maybe that it's overpowering that kind of, but I guess great players, they... It's that composure in those situations that sets them apart.
But I think it's also something about the sort of psychology of low-scoring matches. Because Jack Leach is obviously the most high-profile person to have a scrambled mind, because he's the person who needs to hit the winning runs. But throughout the match, you see decent batsmen effectively just get, you know, caught on the crease, not playing a shot, and just having no idea how to play. And partly that's because the pitch is spinning, and Jack Leach is bowling really well. And the Lancashire spinners are bowling really well as well. But partly I think it's just that thing of when you think, hang on, I'm coming in onto a pitch where no one has been able to buy a run. I just don't know how to play here, and people are caught between, you know, are kind of caught in two minds. It is interesting, actually, the question of the pitch here, because I said at the top that, you know, the Taunton pitch was a bit notorious, and there is actually a system whereby pitches can be sort of officially warned by the ECB, and that you as a team get points reduced if you don't have a pitch of sufficient quality. And many people came out after this game and said, look, what a joke, what an absolute joke of a pitch. Somerset just can't put pitches out like this again. Somerset's director of cricket, Andy Hurry, saw things a bit differently. He said this: there was a combination of good bowling and not very clever batting, which was the case throughout the match. Very few players on either side could find a way of scoring runs. Paul Allott, that's the Lancashire coach, is entitled to his view about the pitch, as are 5,000 people who have watched a really entertaining game of cricket over 2 days. And I think that's a really interesting point, actually, that there is something really compelling when you watch this, when you watch this game, much more compelling perhaps than the game at the beginning of the season when these two sides met, with wickets falling regularly. Suddenly, this was a contest that you wouldn't want every game to be like this, but it was a contest that had its own unique character and actually put batsmen in their own particular and players in their own particular mindset and provided a challenge that you don't necessarily get every game.
Well, Taunton has gained the nickname in recent years of Sidrabad for this these spinning surfaces. And of course, it's this point about variety, isn't it? I mean, why should English spinners be forced to suffer endlessly on pitches that give them nothing, you know, particularly...
Yeah, bowl 47 overs for 3 wickets.
Quite. And then also, you know, it probably is no accident that if you look in recent years, you know, England gave, have obviously brought Jack Leach in. They also briefly gave Don Bess a call, who is in ultimately quite a brief stint in the England team. But, you know, clearly... giving spinners the chance to play on a surface where their captain gives them a bowl and where they take a few wickets isn't a terrible thing for their development.
So for the review this week, we have been reading A Clear Blue Sky, which is a book by, on the cover it has Johnny Bairstow's name in big letters and then in smaller letters, and Duncan Hamilton. Duncan Hamilton, of course, being the cricket writer and historian who, many of whose books we've reviewed on this podcast, Johnny Bairstow being the Yorkshire and England cricketer. If you can hear some funny noises, it's because there's currently a cat draping itself over my microphone. This book was written in, published in 2017. And I suppose to kick off, Andy, what is this book about?
So at one level, this is Johnny Bairstow's autobiography, written, I guess, you'd say maybe halfway, two-thirds of the way through his career. Not an unreasonable time for a player to write at least the first cut of his autobiography. But it's much more than a conventional autobiography. It is a mini biography and tribute to his father, David Bairstow, but also a very personal memoir of the grief at losing his father when he was a child. And in that sense, it stands apart from any biography we have read before on this for the podcast. And I think it's one of the reasons that the book made such a huge impression when it did come out in 2017.
It feels more personal than a lot of sports biographies feel, because you say, and you're exactly right, that writing a biography halfway through your career is kind of the done thing now, and we've reviewed a few on this podcast, but on the whole we tend to steer clear of them because, frankly, sometimes they're written by people who... don't necessarily do it for the right reasons. You do it because it's the done thing and you're going to make some money out of it. And also there's not the right sense of distance and perspective to be able to do this. But for you feel that this was the book that Johnny Bairstow needed to write. Because as much as anything, and its real power, I think, does come from its descriptions of his father. It's the first time, interestingly, at the end of the book, he says something quite telling. He talks about the fact that he knows that people will continue to ask him about his father, but they will be able. He will be able to point them to this book as his answer to that. And there is a sense to which this book sort of puts that to rest in a way. He has the distance. So for anyone who doesn't know the story, when Bairstow was 8 years old, he and his mother and his sister came home to find his father having hanged himself from the staircase, having committed suicide. His father having been the Yorkshire and England wicketkeeper batsman, obviously a model that Bairstow very strongly would follow in over a decade later. And this, Bairstow talks about the fact that at the time, this man was his dad. He didn't really know about him as a cricketer. And this book, and I think this is where Duncan Hamilton probably comes into it. My hunch is this is where Duncan Hamilton comes into it to a significant extent. This book is all about finding out about his father, finding out the stories about his father, what made him significant as a cricketer and as a man, and really kind of catching Bairstow up on that man and all of those stories that he missed out on hearing from his father himself.
And I think those stories, Bairstow talks particularly towards the end of the book about the fact that those stories are what makes you realise the extent to which a figure like David Bairstow has a sort of very considerable afterlife within the game. You know, he's kept alive by these recollections, and Johnny Bairstow always talks about the fact that, you know, much as the memories are painful, it is always a joy to him to have someone come and tell him, you know, your father was wonderful, I remember this time your father did this. That discovery, I think, is part of the grieving process.
And whilst there are moments of the book that I found very, very, very moving in terms of Bairstow talking about his relationship with his father, I think one of the successes of the book is it actually manages to, I don't know what the right words are here, but it sort of moved beyond that in a way. And there are times and whole chapters that talk about his father's career in a way where if you were just to read that chapter, you wouldn't know that it was a narrative that was framed with sort of grief and tragedy. And in that sense, the kind of biographical elements of his father are really effective. And he is a fascinating man and a fascinating player playing in an interesting era of cricket. And in that sense, the biography of his father is really compelling reading in and of itself.
I think it's worth touching on the role of Duncan Hamilton, because as you acknowledged at the start, you know, he's a wonderful writer. The books of his that we've reviewed are some of my favourite cricketing books. And getting Duncan Hamilton on board, it is in itself a statement of intent from Bairstow. He is not a conventional ghostwriter, by which I mean he quite often breaks cover. So
his name's on the cover.
That's
a big difference from usual. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think it also fits with the style, because he is not at pains to stay in character as such. There are quite a lot of moments where he talks about the history, or he kind of offers his reflections and thoughts on the game, and you know as a reader this isn't Bairstow, you know it's Hamilton, and I don't think you mind. I think it adds to it, but I think it's an interesting take on what a ghostwriter can be. Now, parts of this book are more conventional biography, and which of those bits work for you and which don't? I mean, there's accounts of recent series, there are discussions of his development as a player. I mean, I felt that some of these feel a bit like the B side. You know, the A side of the album as such is the memoir of grief and the experience of his father. I mean, how did you feel about the more contemporary?
Look, I think there's what this book leaves room for is kind of the autobiography of Johnny Bairstow's career, him writing about Johnny Bairstow as a cricketer, because we actually don't get a huge amount of that. We get quite a lot of his development as a, you know, as a young man in school, you know, in school cricket and beyond. Again, a lot of that is related back to his father and comparisons with his father and talking about that. And so when we do come to some of the, you know, later, more recent series, you don't get a huge amount of in-depth analysis of I didn't come out of reading that thinking that I knew more about some of those series that I'd lived through and watched than I did before. You know, for instance, the Ashes in 2012, the Johnson Ashes, where he ripped apart England repeatedly. You know, you feel that you don't necessarily learn that much more about that series from this book, but you do really learn about the coming of age moments for Johnny Bairstow. So the book opens and closes with the description of his maiden test century in South Africa. Very, very moving account of that innings. Now, you don't actually learn much about the game in which that innings comes, but you learn a huge amount about Bairstow. So as I say, I think what this book doesn't do and leaves the door open for later is a real analysis of from Bairstow, because he's clearly a man with a huge amount of cricketing insight. And interestingly, I was watching a YouTube video the other day of England players talking about it was a crappy series put together by Sky Sports. I hate admitting that I was even watching this, but it was about England players talking about their teammates, and they say, oh, who's the best dancer and who's the, you know, who has the worst haircuts and whatever. And anyway, one of the questions was who sucks up to the coaches most, and Jos Buttler said, it's Johnny Bairstow. Wherever you go, you will see him talking not only to the England coaches, but opposition coaches. He will seek out anyone he can find to talk to about cricket. Clearly, here is a man with a huge amount of cricketing insight. But that doesn't necessarily in that way come across in this book, because this book fulfills a different function. It really is about his father, his relationship with his father, and what it's like to be a cricketing son following in the footsteps of your father. Just one quick observation on that. There's a very poignant stat that I think is 13 father-son combinations in England history, and the only one where the father wasn't there to watch the son's test debut for England was Johnny Bairstow. His father was the only one who wasn't there.
So that was A Clear Blue Sky by Johnny Bairstow with Duncan Hamilton. Not an easy book to review, I think, because of the fact that it seems like many books in one. I think it will quite naturally be grouped alongside Marcus Trezeguet's Coming Back to Me as a bit of a landmark, where Trezeguet was the first professional cricketer to write so honestly about the challenges of competition and mental health. Bairstow, I think, is the first to write so openly, so honestly about grief. But it ends up being very much sort of a story of triumph and an uplifting book, which I think it is partly why it's made such an impression more broadly.
And that was the 115th episode of Reverse Swept Radio. If you loved it, tell a friend. If you didn't, don't. See you next time.